Renaissance Italy, when physicians were recommending bloodletting for everything from stomach aches to hemorrhoids, and most barbers were doubling as surgeons, some of the most sophisticated medical procedures in existence were skin grafts, transplants of skin used to repair noses eaten away by syphilis or by duels gone wrong. But if you wanted the work done right, you'd be better off avoiding the doctor altogether and getting your nose job done by a peasant farmer. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. See, farmers already had extensive knowledge about plant grafting, and they applied what they knew to the human body with surprisingly impressive results. It was, in effect, the earliest successful form of transplant surgery, a, forgive the puns, branch of medical science with roots in the ancient world far deeper than most of us would imagine. Paul Craddock is Honorary Senior Research Associate in the Division of Surgery and Interventional Sciences at UCL Medical School in London. His book is called Spare Parts: The Story of Medicine Through the History of Transplant Surgery. Paul, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris, and thanks for such a lovely introduction.
My pleasure. You start this history in the 16th century, which was the first era for which you could find reliable accounts of attempts at transplant surgery. But you found ample evidence that people had been thinking about the possibilities of this for much, much longer. How does transplantation figure into ancient mythology around the world?
Oh, well, that's a possibly very, very big question. I suppose first I should say that that transplant surgery as an actual practiced bit of surgery comes from ancient India. So it actually, the practice of skin grafting comes from far, far back. It was mentioned in the Sushruta Samhita, which is an ancient Ayurvedic surgical text. And that was written sometime between the 2nd and the 6th century BC. And even then, skin grafting, along the lines you've described, was considered traditional. So the practice actually goes back a very long time. When it comes to myths, well, I have a few of my favorite myths, and one of my favorites is a Chinese myth about a brave but stupid man. And he was called, I have to apologize for my Chinese pronunciation. He was called Zhu Ertan. So this was the story of Judge Lu, and it was written by a Chinese writer called, well, it's written down by a Chinese writer called Pu Songling in, I think it was 1680. And the story basically is the story of two drinking buddies. So you have Zhu, and you have Judge Lu, who was the judge of the underworld. And basically one night, Zhu got drunk, and he sort of went to the temple and came back home with a full-size image of Judge Lu. And he got drunk and he slurred an invitation to the judge to join him for a glass of wine. Of course, the image didn't respond, but then the next day, the judge actually turned up at Zhu's doorstep. There was a knock on the door, and Zhu opened the door and he saw in front of him the judge of the underworld, which I imagine was quite a surprise. And he thought, oh my gosh, I've insulted the judge of the underworld. He's going to have my head for this. But actually he just wanted to take him up on his offer for a drink, and they became drinking buddies. And one night, Zhu and Lu were drunk, and Zhu went to sleep, and he could feel something happening in his chest. And he sort of came to, and there was his drunken friend with his hands inside of his chest. And he said, don't worry about this. I'm just replacing your heart. Because you see, Zhu was stupid. And the heart in China at that time was seen as the sort of the place where you get your intelligence, your soul in a way as well. So he replaced Zhu's heart with another, a clever heart from the underworld, from the netherworld, and Zhu became a great writer. And I love that story because you also have tacked onto the end of it another kind of transplant. You have a head transplant. Do wants his wife was incredibly ugly, apparently, and he wanted Judge Liu to help her too. So he changed her face.
All right. So obviously people were imagining, what if this sort of thing were a possibility? Some of the first transplant surgeries to really work in Europe were these skin grafts motivated by the desire to rebuild missing noses. Paul, how common was it to see somebody walking around in the ancient world without a nose on their face?
Well, fairly common, actually. I mean, you mentioned in your introduction, Chris, that, you know, there were duels. You said duels that went wrong, but actually it would have gone right, wouldn't it?
Depending on which one you are.
Exactly. Depends on who you are. So you had the duels, you had wars, so you'd have a lot of saber wounds. Also, for much of history and in vast swathes of the world, cutting off a nose, rhinotomy, was a punishment. And also in 16th century Europe in particular, in Italy, certainly in Italy, syphilis was a really destructive disease, much more destructive than the strains we see nowadays. Your nose would rot off. You'd end up with what they call the saddle nose. And in certain parts of the world, you'd have entire cities where people would live, cities of people with no nose.
So
incredibly common, actually. Yeah.
And farmers got good at skin grafts because they understood plant grafting. Was this a kind of sideline for these two Italian families that had these secret techniques that they didn't want to share with anyone?
I don't know if there were sidelines. I don't know. I know that the city, the village that the that one of the families, of the Anio family, the village that they operated in, was a coastal village, and it was also known for its red onions. So they might have had some hand in the local sort of farming community, but certainly they were very well known for this particular operation. And it was an operation that it's probably come down from the ancient Indian procedures somehow. I mean, there are very, very few references before the 1550s. Of transplants of any kind. They probably came down from ancient India in some way, but you know, it's very hard to find an actual link.
Paul, back in the early days of these skin grafts in Italy, where did the skin come from to be transplanted?
Well, there were two locations, really, all on the same body. So you wouldn't have a skin graft from one person to another, although that was presented as a possibility. But you'd have to remain in contact with that person while your skin melded together with them. So it wouldn't be very comfortable. But you would have, traditionally, it would be from the forehead. You'd have a flap of skin. You'd cut around a flap of skin in the shape of the nose from the forehead and sort of pull that off the forehead and attach it to where your nose should be, and it should heal in the shape of a nose if you've done it right. The other location, and this was an Italian invention by all accounts, is from the sort of bicep area. So you'd end up with your arm attached to your face, like you're doing an impression of an impression of an elephant's trunk.
And you just had to wait.
I don't know how else to describe it.
You just had to wait until that all healed up?
Absolutely. That's what you do with plants, and that's what you do with people.
So when this first started happening, it's worth noting that university-educated doctors were learning about human health with, like, humoral theory and the idea that you had to balance different, you know, natural elements. How did the era of cadaver dissection start to open this new world of really understanding how the body worked?
In general, for hundreds of years during the Middle Ages, the anatomist would sort of be, the physician would sort of sit aloof from everybody else, and they would basically read from one of Galen's texts, and they would describe what should be, in the body in front of them. And while this is happening, a lector or some kind of anatomist would sort of point to these different locations. But the thing is that those descriptions in early anatomy were based on descriptions of sheep and pigs and cows, because in ancient Rome, you weren't allowed to dissect humans. So, whatever observations Galen made were made from animals. But not only that, they were looking at translations, Latin translations of Arabic translations of the original Greek. So it was quite a ridiculous state of affairs. Now that all started to change in the mid 16th century. So around about the same time, that the skin grafts we were talking about a moment ago, and that started to change when Andreas Vesalius, who is possibly the world's best known anatomist, started to look at the human body and the translations of texts, and sort of at first sort of thinking, well, the translation might be wrong, but then realizing, no, the translation isn't wrong. We've got to really start again looking at the body and sort of describing what we see, and that sort of being the starting point of any sort of discussion or description of anatomy. So it was a major shift, and anatomy didn't transform overnight, but it was a major shift from trusting the ancient sources to trusting your own eyes, ears, fingers, and nose.
And as sketches and drawings started to be published of human anatomy and musculature, the figures were pictured holding their own skin as if they'd slipped off a jumpsuit.
I've never thought of that description, but I applaud you for it, and I love it. Yes, that's right. I suppose that's a way of sort of, in one way, saying the skin doesn't really matter. The traditional medicine, the skin doesn't matter, it's what's inside. But the transplant surgery, in that period, it really was the skin that mattered.
Blood mattered too, and we don't these days really think about blood transfusions as transplants per se, because we're focused on organs, but people had a sense from early on that maybe there would be some health benefits from some infusion of blood from another source. What do you know about the veracity of these rumors that Pope Innocent VIII engaged in this as like a path to eternal youth?
Oh, who knows about the veracity of those that particular story? It's suspicious that the boys who accepted the money are always painted as Jewish. So I'm not sure that that's a true story. But certainly, the first blood transfusions were carried out in order to hopefully make the recipient younger. So
just to jump in here for a second, people might be wondering what story we're talking about. The story was that some lackey of Pope Innocent's lured three children by offering them some money, and then the rumor was that the Pope sort of bled them dry, hoping to feed off their youthful blood.
Yes, but I'm not sure that that ever took place. But certainly, the first blood transfusions were meant to confer youth on the recipient. Blood transfusion really emerged from a collision between two very different and really incompatible ideas, medical systems, basically. So the first one is the idea that, you know, parts of our body can be seen as mechanical. So you have, you probably already know about the circulation of the blood. So in 1624, that's when William Harvey, a physician, first described this phenomenon that the blood circulates the body and it's sort of pumped around by a heart. So you have this idea that part of the body is a medical, a mechanical device. And what do you do when you are an experimenter and you come across a mechanical device? Well, you fiddle with it. And in this case, they used devices like reeds. So, you know, as in R-E-E-D-S, reeds, porcupine quills, glass tubes and things like that to inject things inside of the bloodstream. So they injected dogs with things at first, like opium. We tried to get the dog high quicker than it would, eating opium. They'd get it drunk by injecting sacks of fortified wine directly into the bloodstream. And they'd tried food as well, milk, but that made the blood curdle. And blood was another one of those substances. And that's where transfusion sort of emerges mechanically. But as I was saying, there are two systems here at play. And the other one is that humoral system that you've already mentioned, Chris. And in fact, any kind of system that was around at that time was sort of fair game because no one really knew what was in the blood. So the person who actually had the thought of transfusing blood and actually tried it out for real for the first time was a man called Francis Potter. Now he's actually better known for a book he wrote on interpreting the number 666. But he was also an inventor, and he was a friend of William Harvey, the man who wrote about blood circulation. And he was chatting with Harvey one night, just around the fire, as you do. And he was sort of, they were each sharing their ideas on mechanisms, mechanical things. And Potter told Harvey about some of the machines he'd invented to lift giant buckets and things. And Harvey was telling Potter about the human machine. And then Potter sort of had a little daydream, and he thought of the story of Jason and the Argonauts, the story of Medea. So basically, in that story, Jason sort of sets himself with a golden fleece. I mean, most people probably know this. You've probably seen the film, which I remember watching as a child. He sets himself off to find this golden fleece, and the king won't let him have this fleece unless he defeats, you know, he meets certain challenges. And I won't go through those challenges because it take ages. But basically, Medea, who's the king's daughter, helps him with these challenges. She casts various magic spells and helps him, you know, fight off armies. And his last challenge was to steal this fleece from outside, from the den of this sleeping, this dragon that never sleeps, and Medea puts the dragon to sleep. So Jason claims the fleece, claims Medea, goes back home, and everybody at home is out to celebrate his return and his men's return, apart from Jason's father. Jason's father is too old to make it out. So Jason's very upset about this, and he just remembers how his wife helped him get this fleece and said, well, can you maybe take some of my blood and give it to my father? And could you probably shorten my life and give put those years onto my father? And he said, no, I can't do that, but I will make a potion. So she sort of, anyway, she does some more. She flies around getting ingredients and things and makes a potion. And then she mixes that potion with Jason's father's blood.
Ah, so here we go. Here's the connection to blood transfusion.
And that magical potion, mixed with Jason's father's blood, given to Jason's father, he started to, his gray hair started to turn black and his wrinkles started to disappear and he was young again. And in London in the 1640s, Francis Potter thought, that's it. That's how you could use blood transfusion. You could take young blood and give it to an elderly person and that could make them younger. But he could never really make it work. He tried it on some chickens, but he complained that his tools were not good. He could never really get anything more than a dribble. But that was the first blood transfusion attempt, and it was exactly to do that, to try to make a man younger. Well, to try to make a chicken younger in this case, but you get the idea.
Your chapter on tooth transplants is both horrifying and frankly incredibly fascinating. Where did donor teeth come from?
All over the place, Chris. They came from, some of them came from battlefields, from a Peninsular War, from Waterloo. In fact, they're known as Waterloo teeth. So people would go to battlefields and they would yank teeth out of the corpses. They would take the teeth from the corpses of hanging criminals, and also grave robbers would be able to sell the teeth, and they could be used in dentures. But occasionally, there's some evidence they were used as well, transplanted directly into the mouth. The most horrifying, I hesitate to use the word donor because I don't think they were freely donated, but the most horrifying place for donor teeth, so to speak, was the mouths of poor children. So this, and it's a symptom of the times. You know, we have 18th century is the start of the modern era. We have fashion, a new concern with beauty. We have industry, we have shopping. You know, and with all those things, we have a widening class system. We have very, very rich people making money off very, very poor people. And it was those rich people who could afford to buy the teeth of the poor.
So, Paul, it's unquestionably unethical. This was abusive. Teeth were stolen from poor children and from corpses. Did it actually work? Can you transplant a tooth from one human being to another and have it take root?
Yes, you can. It doesn't necessarily last very long, and dentures very quickly became preferable at the end of the 19th century. But you can transplant a tooth from one human to another and it work. It depends a lot on how the physiology of those people agree, and that was really happenstance back then, but you could get anything from a few months to a few years out of a good match. You could also get syphilis or another injection and die. And apparently the dead teeth, the teeth we spoke about a moment ago from the battlefields, from the corpses, some dentists swore by those because you could get a better fit. You know, if you can rummage around in a barrel of teeth, you're much likely to get a better fit.
How did scientists conceive of the kinds of bypass devices that would be necessary to keep people alive while they waited for a donor heart or a donor kidney?
Now, this is an interesting sort of wartime well, I suppose if I was to tell the longer story, it would be a wartime story. I won't tell the longer story because we don't have that long. But basically, a kidney, if you think of what a kidney does, it's a filtration system. It removes urea, it removes impurities from the blood. And in the Second World War and just before, a Dutch man called Willem Kolff, another name I'm probably pronouncing incorrectly, he was looking for how he could sort of outsource this this function. And he spoke to a man whose name escapes me at the moment, but he was a professor in the hospital that he worked at. And he used to use sausage skin, well, cellophane, sausage skins to purify fruit juices. And Kolff tried this on his a sample of his own blood mixed with urea, and it worked. In fact, it was more effective than an actual kidney as a filtration system using cellophane. So the war effort, the war being what it was in the Netherlands, it was extremely disruptive. And he built his first bypass machine with sausage skin, an enamel bath, and he set it all in the frame of a shot down German aircraft.
Wow.
And it didn't work immediately. You know, doctors were sending him patients with kidney disease that was far too late, because they thought, you know, he can't really harm them if they're going to die anyway. But it was also too late to start filtering. But the real significance of that, I think, historically, is that, in the context of the other kinds of transplant we've been talking about, is that body parts, because of this, I mean, this was an example of body parts being conceived solely in terms of their function. So you're removing this idea that a kidney, not only a kidney has to be a kidney, but a kidney doesn't have to look like a kidney even. It can be a sausage skin, an enamel bath in the frame of a shot down aircraft. You know, that function of a body is removed from the actual body part as we sort of experience it in everyday life.
Modern organ transplants are still amazing to us, even if we sort of expect them now to be possible because we've had success with this. There are also people transplanting things that nobody in the modern world might have imagined possible, hands and faces. And there you have a rejection possibility that is psychological as much as physical. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. The first person to have a hand transplant, his name was, I think it was Clint Hallam. Now, I'm really trying to accent, I wrote this ages ago. It's Clint Hallam, and he was a felon, I seem to remember, and he lost his hand in some kind of industrial accident. And in France, so when was this? It was the early 2000s, I think. I can't remember now. But I think it was the early 2000s or late 90s, something like that. Anyway, he lost his hand, and the first hand transplant was performed on him. And the surgeons went in great detail, connecting each vessel, connecting each sinew, sort of making this hand functional. And he stopped taking his medication. And he was made to sort of feel responsible for this. And some psychologists have written about this, and they've come to the conclusion actually that if Hallam had not been in prison, no one would have questioned his decision to sort of reject psychologically his hand. They could have just accepted him saying, well, it was too weird to have someone else's hand attached to my arm. But they think that he was painted as a bad patient. You know, he wouldn't accept it because he was a bad patient. So he was made to sort of confess to his being lax with the medication. But yes, he rejected it psychologically, and that led in a way to him rejecting it physically. But on the flip side of that is that you can accept things psychologically. And in 2016, I think it was, there was a story of an Indian woman who'd lost both of her hands in a bus accident. And she had a transplant, a hand transplant of two hands from a male donor who'd died in a motorcycle accident. And she started to accept these hands psychologically, so much so that they started to develop feminine features. And that's a quote. I don't know what that means exactly. Maybe it's a shape thing, or maybe it started to lose hair or something. I don't know. But she accepted it to such a degree that she her hands became her own. They became feminine hands. And she had a Facebook video about this.
We've reached now, Paul, an era when scientists are working to create new body parts from cells derived from patients' own bodies that might be grown in lab settings. In some cases, we're sort of back to where we started with plants, right? How have spinach plants been used in service to growing new heart cells?
Well, they've been used as scaffolds. And basically what that means is there's a team at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in the States. Actually, the leader of that team is now at Harvard, I understand. But, you know, if we've just been talking about kidneys and the kidneys not having to look like like a kidney, just having the function. Well, that is the case for, well, all organs. So we can now sort of, we're getting to the point where we can start to print bits of organs, but there are certain physiological structures that it's just too high resolution for 3D printers to print them. But one of the solutions is to use structures already in nature. So the team in Worcester Polytechnic Institute removed the cells using a detergent of a spinach leaf. So they're left with a collagen frame, and that's basically something that they can then populate with other cells. So they can use that frame to grow human heart cells or skin cells or whatever it might be. And in their experiments, they've sort of said that you could possibly use a spinach leaf with your own cells growing on it to maybe plug a hole in your heart. So it's a way to sort of get around our technological limitations when it comes to printing things like body parts. It's to use that those structures already in nature. And that does, as you said, Chris, bring us around in a beautiful circle, because we did start, the history of transplant starts with horticulture. It starts with a transplant from one plant to another and then transposing that procedure from plant life to human life. That's something that happened many, many centuries ago, possibly even millennia ago. And it's come full circle because we're using spinach leaves now. And the language we use to talk about transplant, it's, you know, we graft still, don't we? We harvest. Well, it's not very fashionable to use the word harvest in the transplant context, but that's still, you know, you still understand that as a transplant word. So it's a very much a leafy kind of procedure.
And human imagination will always matter as well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Paul, thank you so much for making time to talk with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Paul Craddock is Honorary Senior Research Associate in the Division of Surgery and Interventional Sciences at UCL Medical School in London. His book is called Spare Parts: The Story of Medicine Through the History of Transplant Surgery. You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcast by searching for KERA Think, or catch up on what you've missed at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.